Yes, welcome again. Lovely to see you all. So as Badra said, we're partway through a kind of year-long exploration of heroes of the Dharma, so heroes of the Buddhist truth teachings, many of which are, as he said, on this refuge tree, but not necessarily. I was thinking about heroes and how few really good heroes we have these days. What have we got? Celebrities and football players and things. We haven't got real kind of heroes to model our lives on. And I think we do need that. We do need people to look up for, to people to exemplify, embody the ideals we'd like to live by, the values we'd like to live by. People to inspire radical change and heroic effort. Really to inspire us to live really worthwhile, meaningful lives. So yeah, we're looking at different figures that we think do that during the year. And to be a hero of the Dharma, well, they have to be Buddhists, really. They have to really be practicing the Dharma, deeply influenced by the Buddhist teachings, really committing their lives to that. Not just Buddhist and, you know, a bit interested. To be real heroes of the Dharma, they have to be imbued with the Dharma. And they have to embody Buddhist qualities, so Buddha qualities, really, the qualities of a Buddha, to an unusual degree, I suppose. So they have to really be living a life of kindness and awareness. So they've got great human qualities, so they're not only great Buddhists, they're great human beings. They're people that we could really aspire to be like in that way. And they're people that influence a lot of others as well, by the way they live. So they're really devoting their lives to the Dharma and to sharing that with other people. So yeah, we've been travelling through time and space to meet some of these people. We started the year by spending several weeks with the Buddha as the hero of the Dharma. And we've got another opportunity to do that coming up. The first weekend in May, we've got a weekend retreat where we're going to be really imaginatively entering into the world of the Buddha. So we're going to be really imagining what it would be like to be there when the Buddha was enlightened, when he woke up to how things are, and really spending time kind of just really putting ourselves in that world together. So it'd be really fantastic if you could all join us for that. There's still time to book, there's still places, and it's just, yeah, a good way to just all really meet together and really enter into a different imaginal realm. Then on Tuesday nights we've been spending some weeks exploring a hero called Nagarjuna, who taught mostly by meeting his philosophy, which is really what he's famous for, which is all very mind-boggling. He's from the 2nd century in India. And we're now going to be moving into the 8th century in India, starting this evening. After this series on Shantideva, we're going to be looking at our own possibility to be heroes in little ways in our everyday lives in the 21st century. We've got a month called Buddhist Action Month, where we look at things we can do to influence the world here and now. And we'll be going on through the year into England in the 1960s and Tibet in the 11th century and different places in time and space through the year. We've got one more hero we can look at this week, though. On Thursday, we're going into 20th century India to meet Dr. Ambedkar, who really was a great hero, a great man who had a huge influence on India today in all sorts of ways. Very inspiring about the radical change the Dharma can make to society, how we can really change the world around us. So it'd be great if you could come to that too. But yeah, today we're going to India in the 8th century. So we can do that because we've got a TARDIS. We can go wherever we like in time and space, because in our minds we have imagination. We've got this amazing faculty to go wherever we want to. And I was thinking this morning how we all do that the whole time. We just completely live in our imagination. Can you actually count 10 breaths before you're in a conversation that you had earlier today, or you're back at work tomorrow, or you're having breakfast with somebody, or you know, you're somewhere else in your imagination? It's like, just like all the time, we're just living in other worlds. Even here and now, if you think you're very present, all our perceptions are happening in our minds. So we're kind of constructing the world. We're kind of imagining the world is more solid and more enduring than it actually is. We're not really perceiving things accurately. So you could say we're kind of misimagining in a way. And certainly all the time we're imagining things that influence our experience in you know, less subtle ways or less basic root ways. So you'll be having a very different experience of being here if you habitually imagine the world as a hostile and threatening place, than if you are just thinking, wow, this room is like paradise and there's all these really kind people and isn't it great to be with them? If you're sort of looking at the world in that way, it's going to just be very different sitting here. So we're kind of creating the world we're in through our imagination, the way we imagine things all the time. And I think it's really, really powerful if we all imagine the same thing at the same time. So today we're going to imagine India in the 8th century. So come with me into your TARDIS. You may find yourself, you know, back in breakfast tomorrow, but don't worry, we'll still be talking. You can come back. So imagine India in the 8th century was in many ways pretty much as it is today, or certainly as it was, you know, 100 years ago. Hot, dusty, noisy, smelly, colourful. A world with monkeys and parakeets, holy men and cows wandering the roads, wandering the dusty paths. A world of superstition and spirits, gods, strange supernatural beings. A world with markets of spices and silks. And it was a world with powerful kings and tribes, warrior tribes, sort of fighting their territories. And it was a world with a lot of culture. Perhaps surprising to our conception of India in the Middle Ages, actually. So we are going to imagine we're living in the real centre of culture in 8th century India. It's a place called Nalanda, which, yeah, it's the major seat of culture. It's like a Buddhist monastic university. So it's probably something like about half the size of the University of Bristol, something like that. And it's a campus university. It's mostly built of sort of pinkish terracotta bricks, so you've got these lovely rosy buildings surrounded by a wall around it. Someone who visited us here about 100 years ago wrote about his experience, his travels. He wrote about the view from his window where he was staying. He said, "The whole establishment is surrounded by a brick wall which encloses the entire convent from without. One gate opens into the great college, from which are separated 8 other halls standing in the middle. There are regularly laid out towers, a forest of pavilions, railings and temples. The richly adorned towers and the fairy-like turrets, like pointed hilltops, are congregated together around the temple. The observatories seem to be lost in the vapours of the morning, and the upper rooms soar above the mists in the sky, so that from their cells the monks might witness the birth of the winds and the clouds. An azure pool winds around the monasteries, adorned with full-blown cups of the blue lotus. The dazzling red flowers of the lovely Kanaka hang here and there, and outside, groves of mango trees offer the inhabitants their dense and protective shade. So that's setting the scene. That's where we're all living together. And we're living there with a few thousand people. The reports seem to be between 3,000 and 10,000, but 3,000 would be a lot. We're all men, I'm afraid. This is, don't take it personally, girls, this is the Middle Ages in India. And we're monks, we're living a monastic life there. So we're there, we've probably each got a simple monk cell to sleep in, maybe with a little niche for our current reading book, our current Dharma text, and maybe a little niche for a little Buddha statue or something. And we have the shared use of the temples and the debating halls, the bathing pools, and a huge, huge library. And there are Buddha statues everywhere, including a 24-metre-high copper image of the Buddha. So there's reminders of awakening, of enlightenment everywhere. So it's very religious, monastic life we lead. Every morning a bell rings and that's the time to go and have a kind of ritual bath in the pools that surround the sleeping rooms around the edges of the campus. So hundreds of us might be going down to bathe together at that time. And each evening there's chanting of hymns and mantras and reading of sacred texts and processions with incense and flowers between all the different temple buildings and this very sort of ritualised life. But most of all, it's a place of learning, a place of preserving, and a place for rejuvenating, refreshing, developing the Buddhist teachings. So it's like we're living in this kind of ferment of learning and debate. Just all the different teachings are really alive. There are scholars and practitioners from all schools of Buddhism. So there are people who are really learned in the earliest teachings of the Buddha, and who are perhaps copying out those texts all the time very carefully to make sure that they can be passed on through history and spread through time. People come from all around the world to be taught here. People come from China and Japan and Korea and Turkey and Persia, Indonesia, Tibet, to learn about Buddhism and take texts back with them. But there's all sorts of different practices going on. People are also specialising in, say, the teachings of Nagarjuna, who we've been learning about on Tuesdays recently, these sort of very profound philosophies that are just a few hundred years old. And all the time the Dharma's been kind of reinventing itself to be fresh and real and relevant to people. So there's new teachings coming out all the time, and people are really getting deeply into all of them and debating them together. So there's all this going on. People are also, there's a kind of wide curriculum, so we also learn about other philosophies current in India at the moment, so that we'd be able to debate those so we know where they differ from the Buddhist teachings and where they, we can kind of argue with the people around us about what makes most sense. We're learning logic, grammar, medicine and magic as well. And some of us even learn law and astronomy and city planning. So there's a whole university curriculum going on, very broad. And so, we're just all part of this really varied, live sangha, really immersed in the teachings. So it all feels very intense, actually. It's like a crucible of different teachings all kind of meeting together and deepening together, a really very intense, very fervent kind of atmosphere, very enthusiastic. So we're all practicing there together. So amongst us, there's this monk called Shantideva. So this is who we're going to meet. And actually, he's not really joining in. He's not really playing his part in all this exploration. So we start to notice this. He seems to actually spend most of his days on his bed in his cell. Or maybe I often think he's often in a hammock in the mango grove, in that lovely shade of cool shade of the mango trees. So he doesn't much come to the rituals, and he doesn't much come to the debates, and he's not really doing much teaching. He's just kind of layabout, really. So I start to feel a bit irritated or a bit curious about this, and I'll start to talk to you about it. Well, what is wrong with him? And maybe you're a bit kinder than me, and you actually go and check up and see if he's all right, and come back and say, well, actually, he seems quite well and quite content. So I'll moan a bit more. I've somehow got bugged by the fact he's not really joining in. And I talk to some more people. And someone goes to try and chivvy him in to join in, you know, kind of nag him a bit. Why isn't he doing it? But he's just doing what he's doing, lying on his bed, and he's quite all right there. But, yeah, we just start to really feel he's kind of letting the side down, and he's just like, what's the use? What's the use of having a monk who's not really helping? He's not helping out around the place, he's not teaching us, he's just a lazy layabout. So we kind of start to gang up on him in a way. We're talking to each other all the time, kind of, you know, moaning, having a go at this guy, at poor Shantideva. Someone says he's supposed to be a great visionary, but, you know, you wouldn't know it. What's the point of that? Really, he just sleeps and eats and shits. Between us, that's the conclusion we come to. That's really what he does. That's his attainments, and that's about the end of it. And that becomes his name with us. You know, we sort of start to always refer to him as, well, that guy who eats, sleeps, shits. That's all he does. No use to anybody. No insight, no teaching. And we build this kind of resentment up to such a pitch that we decide we're going to just show him up, really. So we say, I know, let's get him to do the big teaching this week. That'll show up what he knows or how little he knows. So next time we're all gathered, the whole campus, the whole Sangha's together, he's going to do the teaching. So one of us goes to tell him, okay, Shantideva, you know, next Thursday you're it. The whole thousands of monks are going to be there. You're going to do the teaching. And he goes, says, oh, okay. So I thought he'd go and spend the week in the library, actually. I thought this might get him off his bed, the sort of anxiety about having to prepare this talk. But actually, no, he still just carries on lying around the place. Doesn't seem fussed at all. So we're talking to each other and we decide, let's really show him up. He thinks he's so great, he doesn't even have to go and study. Let's make his teaching seat really high, just because he's so high and mighty. So between us, I think a giggling band of quite young monks start building this seat higher and higher, until actually you'd need a ladder to get to it. He won't be able to reach this seat, so we're all waiting for him to come in to see what happens. No, he won't be able to get onto his teaching platform. And waiting to see what he makes of that, really. And the day comes and he walks in, and maybe some of us do feel a bit sorry for him and a bit ashamed of ourselves. Some are a bit puzzled, you know, what is going to happen here or what's going on. Perhaps they haven't been part of the gang. And some of us are still kind of eager to see his comeuppance, really, see what happens. And he just walks in perfectly calmly and just reaches out his hand and magically brings the seat down, takes his place and starts to speak. So none of us was prepared for that. And we certainly weren't prepared for what he had to say. He just starts to speak very clearly, very confidently, and actually quite modestly, which was a surprise. And he speaks verses of great beauty and great profundity that go on and on and on. He asks first, did we want something familiar or something new? We said, or something new. So he just spontaneously speaks 1,000 verses. So he starts out saying, in adoration, I make obeisance to the Buddhas and to the Dharma and to all those worthy of praise. Nothing new will be said here. nor do I have any skill in composition. Therefore, I do not imagine that I can benefit others. I do this to perfume my own mind. While doing this, the surge of my inspiration to cultivate what is skillful increases. Moreover, should someone else of the very same temperament as me also look at this, then he may benefit from it too. This opportune moment is extremely hard to meet. Once met, it yields the welfare of mankind. If the advantage is neglected now, how will this meeting come again? At night in darkness, thick with clouds, a lightning flash gives a moment's brightness. So, sometime, by the power of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of goodness. Even so, the power of good is always weak, while the power of evil is vast and terrible. What other good could conquer that, were there not the perfect awakening mind? This is the benefit seen by the Buddhas meditating for many aeons, whereby deep welling happiness elates immeasurable masses of beings through happiness alone. Those who long to transcend the hundreds of miseries of existence, who long to relieve creatures of their sorrows, who long to enjoy many hundreds of joys, must never abandon the awakening mind. So he just carries on and on in this vein. And it's absolutely extraordinary, absolutely just so affecting, so deep, just to listen and open to what he's saying. So Shantideva's giving us some verses of worship, of devotion. Really sort of extravagantly ecstatic, poetic verses. Just really praising the wonders of the awakening mind, that potential in all of us, the volition we have to open to something more than our small, selfish ways of being, something beyond that, our disconnected, cut-off ways of being in the world, the possibility of letting our energy flow and be of use to others, that whole possibility for there to be something more to our lives than we've known so far. That seed of that in all of us is such a wonderful thing. And Shantideva is just completely like in love with that possibility, that seed in each of us. So there's these ecstatic verses of devotion. He's offering the most beautiful things in the world, the most lovely perfumes, the most lovely natural things, the most lovely built, jewelled things of the world, in praise of this potential in us. And his praise is just so full that it really resonates in me as I'm listening to him, as he's talking to us. It sort of wakes up that devotion in me, and I could just really feel, yes, the possibility of enlightenment, of awakening, of being of use to the world, of making something of my life. It is something real and something so precious that, yes, I want to offer myself and everything precious in the world to that ineffable possibility, just as Shantideva's suggesting. There are verses really expressing the most sublime wishes that humanity can wish, the real desire to be of use to the world, of use to other people. Very, very beautiful wishes. Just a few. May I be of sustenance for many, kinds, for the realm of beings throughout space until all have attained release. May I be a protector of the unprotected and the caravan leader for travellers. May I be the boat, the causeway and the bridge for those who long to reach the further shore. May I be a light for those in need of light. May I be a bed for those in need of rest. May I be a servant for those in need of service, for all embodied beings. May I be a wish-fulfilling jewel, the pot of plenty, the spell that always works, the potent healing herb, the magical tree that grants every wish. And, yeah, he goes on and on, these beautiful wishes to relieve suffering, make things okay, be of use to the world. So again, it just takes me out of that self-preoccupation. In fact, as the more he talks, the more it almost sort of rents my heart open in a good way with the kind of possibility and the impossibility of actually living those wishes, of actually really making a difference in the world. The world is so vast and so troubled, and there's so much to do, and I want to be part of that so much, and there's so little difference I can make, and somehow all of that is just very moving and very motivating to listen to. His philosophy is profound. There's whole sections that, as I listen, I just feel a bit baffled by, very sort of mystified, very mysterious, very deep, very lovely teachings. And there's pragmatic advice. Occasionally he just brings me up short with something quite straightforward in a way. There are bits of advice like, there's nothing that remains difficult if you practice it enough. And if you're really troubled about coping with suffering, how about starting with being a bit less annoyed about the gnats and mosquitoes? I often think of that. You know, still, just whenever there's an insect, I'm irritated by them. Yeah, I remember what Shanti Deva says about that. So he spoke for hours, these profoundly moving verses. And as he spoke, he magically ascended from this high platform that wasn't so high. So he started to rise up into the sky, and he went higher and higher till we couldn't see him anymore. We could still hear him speaking. So it was as though these verses were coming from the sky. And he was never seen at Nalanda again. He reappeared in some distant corner of India, but he never was amongst us in the university here again, in the monastery. So we can come back to the 21st century. And think about what we can learn from this story, this hero of the Dharma, from Shanti Deva. I mean, there is a vast amount of inspiration, a vast amount to learn from in his verses, in the book The Bodhicharya Avatara, entering the path, the path of awakening, a guide to the Bodhisattva's way of life. So the Bodhisattva is the supreme hero of the Dharma, somebody who really is devoting their life to the impossible relief of all suffering. So we'll dip into some of this in the next few weeks. We can only sort of touch into a few verses, really. We've only got a few weeks to do it, and there's an awful lot that we could learn, a lot to say. But yeah, a couple of things from his life story. I like the story. It often reminds me, I often bring to mind this monk who just sleeps all the time, who just eats shits and sleeps, to remind myself that you really don't know what's going on with people from the outside. He had this kind of profound realisation, the ability to be eloquent about that, and you wouldn't have known it from the way he was living before that. So, yeah, I like to remind myself that I can't judge someone else's practice or someone else's realisation kind of from the outside very easily at all. We all have different temperaments, we all have different conditioning, we all have lived different lives, we're living in different ways. The way we bring the Dharma into our lives can look very different for different people. And the more we judge somebody, especially if we start to kind of collude with each other on that and gang up and go, oh, you know, so-and-so, he doesn't really, does he, and moan in the way the monks did at Nalanda. Well, the more we do that, we sort of, collect her in these opinions, the more it cuts us off from actually seeing what somebody has got to offer and what wonderful qualities they might have in amongst the annoying ones. And when I find myself really irritated with somebody, it's usually because they're a mirror for something I need to look at in myself. So that's always worth remembering to do too. It's only that irritating quality in myself I can really do anything about anyway. It's not really much point worrying about what somebody else is or isn't doing. So if I think you're lazy, well, probably I need to make a bit more effort. So when the monks were busy moaning and plotting and giggling and busy building that high seat, that high throne for Shantideva, they weren't at that time meditating or studying the Dharma or helping anybody else, really. It wasn't actually, they weren't getting on with their practice. Who was actually being lazy at that point? Presumably Shantideva was on his bed sort of meditating on this great possibility of enlightenment. Meanwhile, the monks who are complaining about how lazy he is are just busy kind of having a go at him and, hatching plots. They're not actually practicing at all. So you can't tell from the outside. And anyway, being busy isn't always the most helpful thing. Another Buddhist teacher identified one form of laziness as being the laziness of busyness, which is often very salutary to think about. So I might be terribly worthily busy with all sorts of important meetings and emails and things like that, plans and things to do. But am I or am I not, at the same time, working effectively with my mental states, working with the precepts, deepening my understanding of the teachings, of the way things are? From being busy, you can't necessarily tell. Well, actually, you probably can. You can probably tell very well how defended and irritable I am, or how open and kind I am, whether actually I'm being effective. But it's not about how many emails I've written or how many meetings I've been to. Sangharakshita, our teacher, says if we want to know how we're getting on, we can look at ourselves and just think, since I encountered Buddhism, have I become just a bit kinder? And that's what we're looking for. So yes, I think Shantideva was practicing very deeply whilst lying on his bed. So although we don't necessarily want to be ever so busy all the time, his example doesn't mean just lay about and do nothing, don't engage, don't bother. What he's advocating in his verses, in his text, in his teachings is actually an incredibly heroic struggle, a sort of struggle in our own minds. It's about the discipline and the training of meditation, really putting ourselves into that fully. It's about practicing the precepts, the ethical guidelines, and getting really clear about the teachings, these profound wisdom teachings. So it's something that actually requires a lot of energy, a lot of dedication. And in fact, there's a whole chapter of his book about vigour, about energy and enthusiasm for practice and how to cultivate it. And some of that's pretty strong stuff too. Within that chapter, he basically looks at two groupings of different qualities that make up vigour. And interestingly, they're kind of not of the flavour of things we usually think of as positive Buddhist virtues. So there's one kind of collection around desire and one around pride, in a way. So it's about taking those energies and really applying them to your Buddhist life rather than things that don't make you happy or don't relieve suffering or don't free you. Channeling those qualities, transforming them. So yeah, there's this grouping of the sort of emotional qualities of desire and delight. How much do we really desire to follow the Dharma, to live a Buddhist life? How much do we really want it? How much do we really value the precious jewels that we might have glimpsed, the jewels of our potential? Whether that's, yeah, whatever form it takes for you, whether that's about love or truth or freedom or making a difference in the world. What could you bring into being in yourself and the world, and how much do you really value that? How much do you want it? And do you delight in, do you enjoy your practice? When you meditate, is that something you look forward to? And really, there are three chapters of the book where there are this, just all these verses of praise of the awakening mind. So really, they're all about really cultivating that delight, that desire, that real deep want to realise our potential. And then there's this group of qualities around what he calls pride. So these are more heroic qualities rather than sort of emotional, longing, wanting qualities. They're qualities of pride, self-mastery and mindfulness. So it's pride in the sense of self-reliance and belief that you can do this and that it's you who has to do it. It's not someone else's job to transform you. It's only you can really do it, and that you can. You can do that. You can make a difference. You can transform completely. He uses all sorts of different images for the sort of how disciplined you need to be. For instance, you should be like someone who's superintended by swordsmen, who is carrying a jar of oil, wholly intent upon it, out of fear of death if he stumbles. So you've got a very full jar of oil, and if you spill a drop, the swordsmen are going to get you. Right. Is your mindfulness that acute all day long as you're carrying this jar of oil? That's pretty high level recommendation. I think these qualities, this real heartfelt desire for awakening, desire to live a worthwhile life, make a difference in the world, and the pride, the dedication, the self-reliance, the discipline to do that, kind of come together in the quality of commitment, or the aspect of commitment. This is what's really needed to really make a difference to our lives. So on our level, it is about just really dwelling on what we value, really letting ourselves know how important it is to us, really dwelling on any moments we've glimpsed the possibility of something more to life. As I said, it might be love, truth, freedom, making a difference in the world, just being something more. And really dwelling on how fortunate we are to have come across teachings that can help us open to that more and more. It's a rare and precious thing. Really letting ourselves know that. It's really a particular coming together that we're all here this evening. It could so easily not have happened for any one of us. And we're so fortunate to be with a group of people who that all makes sense to, who can really inspire, encourage, support, share that path with us. Just really letting ourselves know that that matters very deeply. It's what's going to motivate us to keep going through the difficult times, because they will happen. And really, yeah, committing, deciding that you're really going to do something about this. You really do want to make something of your life, and that is going to take some effort, some dedication. The Dharma has got the power to totally transform you and me and our lives and the society we live in, if we let it, if we really let it in. It doesn't work if we're just trying to fit in a little bit of it now and again when it suits us, when we can fit it around without change. For it to transform your life, you have to be willing to transform your life. If you're just going to try and sort of fit it around the edges a little bit without changing anything, then nothing changes, really. So business as usual doesn't quite work, really. You can make a few little tweaks, but it's not going to be a real deep, radical transformation. So this means asking ourselves some really hard questions. They can be hard because it's really hard to honestly know what the answer is. They can be hard because we don't want to know the answer. They can be hard just because they're so unfamiliar, sort of a bit unthinkable or something. They're just everyday, ordinary things, in a way. Like, if I don't feel like turning out for an evening like this because I'm a bit tired, am I actually going to be more deeply refreshed and nourished by staying home and watching 3 episodes of my current box set than by coming to the Buddhist Centre, meeting with you lot and meditating? Really? Will you grow more in kindness by doing the apparently kind thing of staying home to look after your kids, or by arranging a babysitter so you can be here again next Tuesday? What's really going to make more difference in the big scheme of things? Will I feel more relaxed and peaceful if I stay home to finish off that piece of work, or stay behind late at work to finish off something that's bugging me that I'm a bit stressed about, than by putting it down, meditating, coming back to it another day? Which is actually going to be more effective? Will a holiday in the sun really do more for the world than going on retreat and getting to know your mind better, your heart better, learning how to become a better person, perhaps? Which will do more for me? Which would do more for you? Which actions will do more for other people in the Sangha to help them to progress on the way, on their paths? What actions are going to build the relationships you most want in your life, the ones that have got most potential to really go deep in communication on things that matter? Which actions are going to, bit by bit, drop by drop, add up to make your life more meaningful? What will do more to contribute to a world that's in desperate need of it? It might be something that seems so small. It might be just doing another Metta Bhavana practice. But it's a drop. It's a drop in that vast sea of suffering that you can do something about. So it is hard. It's hard to be really honest about lifelong assumptions and habits and things that you think are the most important, because you always have. It's really hard to experience honestly, truthfully, the results of our choices and how they shape our lives. They're not always the things we want to be the case. But the Dharma is hard. It's challenging. It can take the ground from under us. Sometimes we just don't know which way's up and what we can trust and what's going on, because life that's unfamiliar is unfamiliar. It's unknown, it's different. It can make for tensions in our lives. It can make for a sense of kind of rub and conflict and not quite knowing what to do. And we do have to make hard choices sometimes. And the next step is often not so big. It might just be really committing to meditate every day for the next week. It might be making the arrangements to make sure you can be here next Tuesday, Or it might just be booking that weekend retreat so that you've just taken the next step. It might not be so big or so hard to do the next thing. You just need to work out what it is for you. I'll finish with the opening verses again of the Bodhicharya Avatara, not all of them, but some of them. This opportune moment is extremely hard to meet. Once met, it can yield the welfare of mankind. If this advantage is neglected now, how will this meeting come again? At night, in darkness thick with clouds, a lightning flash gives a moment's brightness. So, sometime by the power of the Buddha, the mind of the world might for a moment turn to acts of goodness. This being so, even so, the power of good is always weak, while the power of evil is vast and terrible. What other good could conquer that? Were there not the perfect awakening mind?